Yeah, so we're doing, so we do the live streaming through Zoom and it's pretty smooth.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. So I see the link on there and I just clicked on it and it looks like it's starting in 4 minutes. I got the
Yeah,
link.
it's up
Nice.
now.
Is scheduled on seven. Wait, yeah, scheduled in 35 at 35.
Cool.
All right, we're up.
Beautiful.
So, want to get started? Michael, kick it off.
Yeah, sure. Hey guys, welcome to the Craft Podcast, where we interview experts in various fields to learn about their disciplines and how they strive toward mastery. And we love talking to people who are passionate enough to master something. And we have each been asking curious questions our whole lives of this craft people, and want to share those conversations with others. So you will love them all. And please be sure to subscribe to our channel and also click the like button if you like our interviews. And let's get right into it. So Dan, like who's with us today?
Today we're joined by Greg Camrad. I want to make sure I'm saying your last
Yeah.
name right.
Cam Rad. Camrad.
Camrad. Greg Camrad. Greg's a data scientist, entrepreneur, has been a corporate leader, and many of us, including Michael and myself, know him from being an insightful voice for anyone who wants to learn about the latest large language model technologies. Particularly recently, the LangChain library and applying them to real business problems or productivity and life problems. Or maybe not all life problems just yet, but
Yeah,
we'll
not
get
quite
there.
yet.
Yeah. But Michael and I have both been learning a ton from Greg's YouTube channel and newsletter. But before that, Greg built a strong corporate career. He spent time leading a data science team at Salesforce. And building the data startup Digits. So we have a ton to learn from his story. Greg, welcome to the craft.
Awesome. Thank you very much for having me, and I'm excited to dive into it today.
Yeah, so let's start with your superhero origin story. Who was young Greg? Were there any signs that this kid would grow up to teach data science and AI on YouTube?
Yeah, there's zero signs. Well, maybe if you talk to my parents, then there might have been something there. No. I mean, no early signs there. I can't say that I have an origin story. It all kind of started when I had my first job out of school. I was doing corporate FP&A. And what that means is that you're doing big budgets for other companies, right? And so the very first instance that I knew that I was a spreadsheet-minded kind of data nerd was they would give you a list of transactions. And then this just looked like absolute gibberish when I first saw it. And it was a bunch of rows, bunch of columns, had no idea how to get into it. And they said, Greg, go extract an insight from this data. And so all of a sudden, it was me needing to dive into the spreadsheet and go pull out a story. Because once you have the numbers, well, then you got to go present them to people too. And so I found that I weirdly enjoyed that. I turned into an Excel monkey and I was using the keyboard, no mouse, and I could really kind of just feel the spreadsheet and go get good stuff from it. So I would say that was the first instance when I knew that, hey, Greg, you should probably lean into this a little bit more.
Right. Well, that's the data side, but most data people don't end up, on a camera sharing stuff
Oh,
with
sure.
large audiences.
Yeah. So I guess my first foray into it was back in 09 actually, and I did tutorials on YouTube, but it wasn't for what you'd think it'd be. It was Photoshop tutorials.
Wow.
So for some, because back then we're talking old school Photoshop 09, and photo editing kind of just like blew my mind, because you had this thing that you think looks static, but then all of a sudden you can apply your creativity and switch the colors and do all this other fun stuff to it. And it was back when photo editing was still hard. So I would teach people how to go do some of this stuff, and I'd throw it on YouTube. No face, no name, no personal brand, no nothing. I had no idea what I was doing. So those were my first videos back in 09. I was, and I know I'll date myself a little bit here, but I was 19 at that time doing my first videos on YouTube.
Yeah. And that was fairly early days for doing tutorial type stuff on.
Oh yeah. I mean, it was early days of YouTube. I mean, we're talking like, you know, now there's enough CSS to make it look nice and flowy and it looks modern. Back then, we're still talking no rounded corners, sharp edges, like the old school MySpace looking type of YouTube versus what we have today.
Right.
Yeah.
But you must have gotten some kind of like positive feedback from those early forays that gave you the, I guess, the confidence, the interest to keep doing it throughout your career.
You know, I would say it introduced me to the topic, which I thought was cool, right? But I was doing random videos. I did videos of my stepbrother. I did Photoshop tutorials. I did like stop motion animation videos, kind of just throwing everything that's up there. Yeah. I took a stop motion class at college, which was really fun. But what really convinced me to like double down on it and like go hard on it was during COVID, at the beginning of COVID, I was just reading a bunch of business books. And one of those was the Rich Dad, Poor Dad one. And I liked half the book. The first half I really liked. The second half was kind of just way out there for me. But what they really drill into you is the concept of assets, right? And I know everybody knows this, but assets are things that you put your energy into and they end up compounding for you, right? Mm-hmm. When you stop putting your energy into it. So we usually think of it as financial assets. You know, you go make an investment, but another huge type of asset is a content asset. So much like y'all are doing with your content right now, after we record this video, the video is going to live on forever and people will be able to see that and keep on viewing on it. And it's going to do work for you while you're not working anymore. So that motivated the heck out of me. And so I started, this is like, you know, like I said, like 2020, so beginning of COVID, I doubled down on content, but specifically for data analysis. So I was teaching people how to do pandas, which is a popular Python library. And the way that I did it is I took the 60 most popular pandas functions by SEO strength. So the most Googled to the least Googled. And really, I didn't like anybody's content out there because there was either like automated content, which wasn't very good. This was before LLMs. And so it was like really bad content. Right. Or there was like kind of like lifeless one-off tutorials that really weren't really done at scale. So I said, you know, I'm going to do this different and I'm going to go for the high quality play. So I did a video, I did a Jupyter notebook, and I did a blog post for every single one of those 60, which took 2 months because I did one per day.
Wow.
And so that's when I kind of like got really into it. And then I'll skip forward to the front part, but then late last year, you know, ChatGPT is coming out, AI is getting huge. And I looked and there was a lack of content and educating people how to do this type of material on, especially YouTube. And it hit me. I was like, dude, you got to redo what you did for pandas, but you got to do it for this.
Right.
Because this, it almost felt like my pandas work at the time. It felt like it was like the ends, like, oh, I just did that. It's just sitting over there, whatever. But looking back at it, it's almost like that trained me to really, really take advantage of this opportunity now and to connect with a whole lot of people. So when I started doing this AI stuff, it wasn't from scratch. And so I learned some things along the way. And I think that helped me out a little bit.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Because I think to onlookers and even to, I think us, when we started doing these podcasts, like we look at people who have been doing it for years and it's just, they look fully formed. As your videos today do. But there's like, there's a buildup over time. There's probably a million little tips and tricks and just good practices that you build up over time. I guess starting in 2009 with Photoshop.
Photoshop tutorials, right?
Yeah. Amazing. But so that's just one kind of aspect of kind of your early life and career. But you didn't, you were a very busy kid, in college. You had worked a bunch of, like service jobs during college. And I found in my life, those were some of the jobs where I learned the most. What did your experience in different service jobs, like teach you about life and how you wanted to spend your time?
Yeah. So the reason why those came around is I went to Loyola Marymount down in Los Angeles, California, and it's a very expensive school. And after I got done with my freshman year, my dad told me, he pulled me to the side. He said, "Hey, Greg, you can't pay for your other 3 years like you paid for freshman year. You're going to be way too in debt." Because I pulled out a fat student loan freshman year, and I'm an 18-year-old guy. But 18-year-old kid. I have no idea what money means, right? Especially in the tens of thousands of dollars that we're talking about for student loans. And so I looked at my options in sophomore year. I went to community college. And what's wild is that community college, the same year that cost me tens of thousands of dollars at LMU, was $700 for the entire year at community college.
Yeah.
Credits transferred, everything was just fine, which was wild to me. But the reason why I could go back to LMU for junior and senior year is because I joined a program that they had called the Student Worker Program. Mm-hmm. And if it wasn't for that program, I wouldn't have gone back to LMU. It completely changed my college directory. And mm-hmm. so the trajectory and the way that it worked was you got a full-time job and they paid something like it was half to three quarters of your college tuition, but the full-time job was working on campus. And so sometimes it was trash duty. Sometimes it was, setting up chairs for graduation. Sometimes it was, rolling around and doing odd jobs for professors and things like that.
Yeah.
It was amazing for me. Right. And not only that, but it really instilled the value of working to earn your place at this university. So I didn't have the luxury of falling back and having it being paid for through whatever means. Right. And so through financial aid, through student worker, and I ended up going back. And junior year, I think I took out maybe like it was either $5,000 or $10,000 for a student loan. And then senior year, I didn't have to take out a loan because of financial aid and because of the student worker program. So it was a really, really big thing for me at the time.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. And you made it through, and I guess you made it out with low or almost no debt, which is hard.
I wouldn't go that far because I was still carrying my freshman year like massive amount. So
that's
they give you a 6 month grace period after you graduate where your bank you don't need to pay payments, right? They want you to get on your feet. I remember that I had a high interest rate at that time. What I thought was high. It was like 7 or 8%, right?
Yeah.
As like,
we're back there now,
but as a kid, and I just remember my mind being blown where I'm just making up numbers now. I have no idea what they actually were, but I put in $1,000 towards my student loan and my balance only goes down $200.
Right.
And I'm like, what just happened? Anyway, so that was my lesson into interest rates, way back then, that's a whole nother story too, because the thing that helped me pay off my student loans was really getting a higher paying job. Mm-hmm. Like I know a lot of people are like, just grind and put everything you can into it. But it wasn't until I got a higher paying job that I could really make a dent in my loans.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it kind of ties back to the reading Rich Dad, Poor Dad, thinking about what kinds of assets can you build that will, we're not claiming passive income or any kind of secrets to becoming a billionaire, but doing things that could that you could create that then would be useful assets instead of debt, which is what a lot of college students kind of end up with throughout their lives. But so you were also active in other ways in college. You joined a fraternity, Sigma Chi, but you weren't just like a member. You, I think, were president.
Yeah.
What did you learn there about building community? I'm sure because I would imagine there were probably parallels to building teams and maybe even building a YouTube community later on in your career.
Yeah.
Or maybe not.
YouTube maybe, but either way, the fraternity was a hugely transformational process for me at LMU. I mean, it was my life, right? And so I joined second semester freshman year and I was through it through the rest. It was an amazing opportunity, not only because of the service that we all did too. So we did a lot of community service, but then the brotherhood with all the guys that you're hanging out with and the involvement in school, it just was a very active way to participate in university. And it's not for everybody. Totally cool. It resonated well with me and I liked it. And so what was I going to say about, going into, it was like second semester, junior year, and there's about to be elections for leadership positions in the fraternity. And I forget where I had the spurt or the energy, but it was one of those quotes of like, if not you, then who, right? And, you know, I had another huge spurt of motivation. And I remember sitting in a classroom with a friend and just pounding out kind of like, what is my pitch? And like what is my platform and my campaign and all that? And ended up doing the rounds. Because the way that you do elections is, you know, you basically give your presentation in front of everybody. And the voting process isn't very sophisticated. It's a raise of hands. But either way, I ended up getting it. And that was my first leadership position. And more than anything, it instilled into me the confidence that, hey, dude, if you want something, go after it. And then now, because of this confidence that I had, it had me do other leadership positions throughout life, which that was the really first big stepping stone that made me believe in myself, which was really awesome. The other lesson that I learned while being president, which I'll say right now that is carried with me through life, is getting the fraternity to do anything was a big pain in the ass, right? If you needed volunteers for something, you needed, basically volunteers for a lot of things. And if you send out a text message to the fraternity-wide channel, nobody would respond, right? And I'm looking at the room while I'm having one of my chapter meetings, and I'm thinking to myself, but that's so weird, because if I asked anybody individually, they would say, yes, of course, dude, Greg, I got you, no problem. So at that moment, I realized if you want to get support with somebody, you really need the connection with them, and you should really reach out one-on-one, because then they're going to do they'll do anything you need for them. But doing a mass email or a mass text message, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. Right. That's key leadership insight for dealing with groups. And
yeah.
And the same is true if they're your employees and you're paying them versus volunteers. The same dynamic occurs, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So then you took those lessons forward, and then after college, you mentioned getting into corporate finance initially, and you kind of had the spark of like finding insight in data and then taking it to, you know, other team members and explaining it.
Yeah.
Eventually, I guess you fell out of love with corporate finance and more in love with data science.
Yeah. So you got to put my, if I put myself in my shoes back then, right? I was working in a cubicle. I know it's like funny, but like that's completely foreign these days, but I was working in a cubicle and I was doing finance and living in the Bay. It was also in the South Bay. So for those with the Bay Area geography, San Francisco's, you know, there's a lot going on there. Old school Silicon Valley is going to be down in the South Bay. And that's where this company was. And so I'm doing finance. It feels like the world is kind of passing me by because I'm hearing all this tech movement. I have nothing to do with product, nothing to do with Eng, nothing to do with building new things, investors, or the progress forward. Right. You know, I'm doing budgets. And no hate for anybody doing budgets. Just me as a 23-year-old, it was not vibing with me well. My clothes are too big. I didn't know how to dress. I had to wear tucked-in shirts every day. You know, that type of thing. And so more... More than anything, it was just a restlessness to want to get out. And so I went and traveled, basically. I left, I think it probably was about 6 months or 7 months or 8 months or something like that. Backpacked Europe. I worked at a hostel in Italy, which is where I got some hospitality experience, which was crazy. It was one of those live work exchanges where they don't pay you, but you can stay there for free and you can eat for free, which is a good deal. Yeah. I was fabulous. And then I came back to the States and I had this realization where it's like, dude, you can't just go land back in San Francisco, because then it's like you left and nothing changed and nothing was to show of this big, you know, kind of chapter change that you had in your life. And so I found myself in DC, and when I was in DC, I started to inch my way into Python. So at this point, I only knew Excel, but still to this day, And I very, very thoroughly believe that if you know Excel, you can learn to code Python. It's not the same, but if you think about Excel, you're working with tabular data. You're working with rows. You're working with columns, fields. You're working with if statements. I mean, you're not that far off from doing Python.
Yeah.
And so I was doing that. And then I found a PDF, and I think it was called Data Mining for Programmers or Data Mining for Practitioners or something. I can share it afterwards for show notes. But yeah. I read that, and the author made the topic of data science so approachable.
Mm-hmm.
It blew my mind. And one of the first exercises was to implement a recommendation system. So not only talk about what it is, but then implement it. And it was like, wow. So a recommendation system is only measuring the distances between users and the ratings that they have on you know, songs or whatever, and then seeing which user you're most similar to, and then recommending something from their library.
Yeah.
That's cool. And so I got inundated on this idea. And then but this was just me messing around in my studio, right?
Right.
How do I take it to the next level? This was back in 2015. And it was when boot camps were big, but right. web boot camps were big and mobile boot camps were big.
Mm-hmm.
There was no data science boot camps. There was one, and it was called Zipfian Academy. And they had just started. But I looked at their website, and it said, of our graduates, 95% get a job within 6 months, and your average out of job salary is double what I was making at corporate finance. So I was like,
good stats.
I like this. It's a technical skill, which I know is in high demand. I'm probably going to get a job, and my job is probably going to pay me double. Yeah, sure. I'll go and do this. So I applied and I took an interview. I have no idea why they ended up taking me. There was one section on the stats that I just completely bombed with, Poisson distributions and things like that. So I did that anyway, ended up getting in. I got my student loans delayed for another 3 months because the third party lender, Wells Fargo, actually was very generous. And it was an uncommon request that I say, hey, can you stop this for this time? Cause it's another schooling. I'm trying to better myself, et cetera. They were down for it. They stopped it. I took the program. I went heads down for 3.5 months, like 12 hours a day. That's where I picked up Python, picked up Pandas, hit the job market hard, and ended up getting a job at Salesforce. And that really changed. I mean, that changed my entire career. Not only was my career identity different, but I was getting paid more, and I was now in San Francisco in the tech scene. So it totally changed it for me.
Wow. Yeah. So cool that you kind of like saw this, what you wanted to be doing. And then over, I guess, the course of several months taken, I mean, through a lot of hard work, but you made that transition happen. And then you ended up on this trajectory that probably like maybe a year, 2 years before seemed like a total dream.
No, believe me, man. Like I was in my, DC studio apartment and like really like down on myself, just thinking like, what the heck am I doing? Where am I going? What's the path in life? Where, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing that initially turned me on to that, that PDF was I was just tinkering around with stuff. Like, I was just trying to tinker with data, tinker with a little bit of Python. Like I had no idea what I'm doing, you know? Anyway, so the tinkering got me, it was a stepping stone to getting forward.
Awesome.
That's pretty cool. Yeah. And also like maybe go on to that. So, I mean, that since that has been like for a long time. So right now you're becoming really seasoned and experienced. So like, how do you see the evolution of the landscape of data science from your perspective?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
So back in 2015, that was when the article was coming around that somebody had wrote that was like, oh, data science is going to be the sexiest job of the 21st century. Remember that whole phase? That was a little while ago, right?
Yeah.
It's wild because nobody would say that now. They'd say, you know, like an ML engineer or something like that. But so that was going on. So at Salesforce, that was a corporate data environment, right? Which is completely different than a startup data environment. There's pros and cons to both. Back then, data science was, well, there's kind of two routes. I mean, it's kind of even the same now. I mean, you have your really, really deep ML, like research academic side. Right. And then you have your more practitioner application. Let's use algorithms to go do cool things. And that's the route that I ended up going. So I was a person who would use classification algorithms, who would do time series forecasting, who would do regressions and things like that to go do product analytics at Salesforce. And so I stepped into this role unbeknownst to me, really, because I was still figuring it out. It was a growth role, which is a Venn diagram of good data skills, but then also the application side and doing it within product analytics, but then also trying to storytell to your stakeholders, like what the heck your recommendation is to go do.
Right.
So data science back then was kind of like vanilla random forests. Like that's the easiest way I can like go spin up scikit-learn, go open up a Jupyter notebook, go do a train test split and go mess around and go tune some hyperparameters and go do grid search to try to find the best ones and, you know, all that other stuff. And that was also when you did it on with your local data sets. And so like you could load up a lot of data sets within your own Jupyter notebook. It was no big deal. Right. Now, I mean, the tools are just so much more advanced and it almost seems like people are moving past the vanilla classification algorithms, where if you're using random forest, that's almost like you do it because it's only two lines of code and you just want to try it out. People are moving on to more sophisticated types of things. And I won't speculate about where it's going, but with the AI stuff, there's just a lot more question marks around what types of skills should you invest in right now, if you wanted to, you know, leverage your energy as much as possible.
Right.
Right. And also it seems that the LLM, like recently, I mean, it's the reasoning ability is getting better. And then like we can see the first demo of like how an LLM will do like a data science kind of project. It's from the code interpreter on ChatGPT with GPT-4 model. And that's just seems like the beginning. And because I got a friend like who was also working in data science, and we were talking about this topic and he was like, okay, like maybe I'll be replaced someday. And with that, so like they're trying to find, you know, what's the next direction I'm gonna take and trying to leverage this instead of
so, you know, I it's starting. Like the whole like, oh, maybe I'll get replaced. It's like, yeah, one day for sure. But I like to leave those for like kind of like philosophical conversations around the fireplace, that type of thing. Like today, like actual, like if I'm a college student just about to graduate, what am I doing today? I'm still learning the fundamentals. I mean, I guess if we're talking about data science, I'm still learning the fundamentals of data science. Until there's a tool that comes out there that there's always going to be tools that you need to learn to uplevel in your job, right? If you're worried about getting replaced, that's a rough place to be in. The advice I would give to you is stay at the forefront of what's coming out for your specific industry. Yeah. If you do get replaced, it's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to be like, hey, Monday morning, you don't have a job anymore. It's going to be a slow transition. And like any competitive professional, and when I say competitive, I just mean somebody who's active in learning in their career, you're going to have to learn the tools. People had to learn computers. They had to learn the internet. They learned SaaS, you know, anybody who didn't learn the SaaS software, or they were anti that, well, they didn't get by very long and they're definitely not having fun right now. So I'm not worried about anybody getting replaced right now. I think there's ample opportunity for you to uplevel your skills all over the place.
Right. Yeah, definitely. So I think for data science, there's like actually a lot more, I guess. It's just a lot deeper than we usually think, for different levels of knowledge and also value that you know, human or scientists or professionals have to do. So it's not like,
I totally agree. And the other thing too that I think people overlook is a single job function is not a single workflow, right?
Right.
Like even if we were just take a small example, data scientists, where do they get the requirements from? Well, it's usually a stakeholder that they have that tells them what is a priority for the business and what they need to go do. Okay. So is a stakeholder going to input a prompt and get an answer out? No. So yeah. The human is also a huge storyteller and interpreter that comes with it. So I think the most likely example is that data scientists, yes, they'll still have their jobs. Some of their mini workflows will get a little speed boost, right? Just like DBT comes out and helps people with the ETL process. And there's a lot of really cool things with it. Well, a lot of people are learning DBT and now they're speeding up and they're going faster and things like that. So I think the same thing will happen with AI. Like, hey, can you go do exploratory data analysis for me? Go give me some good stuff back. Okay, cool. Now I'm going to double click myself and do manually, you know, go dive deeper into a section here, but right. No one's getting their job replaced overnight.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, we're also interested, like, are you building, so because on the tutorials in your channel, so you're working on the LangChain, and that was pretty cool because it's really useful and helpful for us, especially that we're trying to learn. And are you building any like exciting or interesting projects or products, or even your current position at the new startup Digis?
Yeah,
you mind sharing that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually left my position at Digis. This was in January of this year, so January 2023. Oh. And since then, I've been on my own, and a major portion of that has been doing content for the AI space. Now, what has been surprising to me is the amount of reaction that had come from it. And I think it was a lot of right place, right time. And that's totally cool. I think a little bit of it too was that I found a way to try to position content that I think has a little bit of a reaction that comes from the audience, which is awesome. And so now there's a big open question, which is, hey, when you have YouTube subscriber growth and a little bit, not much, but just a little bit, and you have a little bit of Twitter growth, what are the routes in front of you to go have some fun, right? And so the way that I'm answering that question for myself is you have to think about your personal goals, not even career, but like, what kind of life do you want for your family? What life do you want to live? How do you want to grow? Just all those other stuff. You start with what's important to you and your values. And then from there, you back out a plan, just like anything else at work. I mean, it's not rocket science, right? And so I've done that with myself and I've backed it out. And as of right now, I'm having a lot of fun and getting a lot of good ROI on the content side. And the content side is kind of a trite word that's overused, but really I like making cool projects and I like sharing them with people, and right. it's been fun, right? And so I think that the piece that I'm leaning into right now is that though I've gotten popular over tutorials thus far, I don't necessarily want to keep on doing tutorials, right? There could be one route where I want to go do a school type of environment and I, you know, teach people how to do that. But I've told you my background. At my core, I'm not a software engineer, right? I'm a B2B products guy who really, really likes seeing product scale. I really like extracting an insight from a customer and figuring out what to build. I really like looking at a market landscape and figuring out how do we position ourselves for it. I really like data analysis. I really, you know, I like a lot of other things that come with it. And so I think a school maybe not quite yet, especially on the software engineering side. And then on the company side, that is 100% in my purview for sure. But I don't want to rush into it. I want to do something that's like, when it hits me and the right people come into play, the right idea comes into play, then I want to say, you know what, I'm ready to go tackle that for now. However, the content side right now, people often say how you make content and it ends up being a top of funnel for you. It's absolutely true, because a lot of cool opportunities have come, a lot of speaking opportunities, a lot of meeting really cool people, a lot of meeting really cool VCs, and meeting really cool sponsors too. So I'm starting to do a little bit of sponsorship content for the content. But my approach right now, like I said, I'm just being long-winded, but I said, I don't want to be just known for tutorials. So if I think about the intersection of business and the AI space, I think to myself, what really, really excites me right now? And the thing that just freaking fascinates me so much is, where is value going to accrue in the AI space and business? Like, how is AI going to help business people do more? Like, I'm not talking about which jobs are going to get replaced. I'm talking about today. Like, the marketing person on your team, they log in on Friday morning. What could they be doing today that's going to help your business out? And talking to people about that, hearing those stories, it's just been extremely fun. So the last thing I'll say, then I'll pass it back to y'all, is I just heard about this concept of the AI committee at the workspace, right? I had no idea what this was. I was talking to a VC. They said, yeah, we're starting our AI committee at work right now. I said, what's that? They said, oh, well, it's a group of employees that are tasked with figuring out what we should do internally to get better at AI at our workplace. I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. And I tell my wife that, and she goes, we just got an email about that today. We have our own group doing that right now. And so this is the perfect type of problem and just such an interesting thing that I'm really fascinated by. So I sent out a tweet and I end up getting 12 user research interviews of people who are doing AI committees. And it's like, heck yeah, let's talk about this. What are you doing? What's what's not working? And so I'm putting out a video on that probably later this month on what I learned from it. But those are the types of things that I find really interesting.
That is cool. That is very cool. Yeah, I'm glad that you're hop on your new journey and feels like really exciting. And also maybe one last question on this topic is that, like, you back in when we were at the data intelligence team, mm-hmm. At Salesforce, and you worked you started from the doing data science, data analytics, and then mm-hmm. you became the director of the team, mm-hmm. and leading a bunch of data scientists, I guess. But so, is there any valuable lessons that you learned through the process, like especially in a corporate setting in data science field, and you became a leader in this field? And
I would say that the biggest one that's standing out to me even today is the amount of storytelling that happens within a corporate data team. Now, if you're in academia and you're doing research and you're doing deep ML, okay, there's not a ton of storytelling that goes on there, and that's okay. You know, you're doing your research project. But when you're in a corporate environment and you have stakeholders, and you only have so much energy that you can expend, you have to make sure that that expenditure is going to good use, right? So I have a topic for a very long form article, potentially even longer, that's all around the empathy that an analyst needs to build before they can do good data analysis. And it's really three parts, right? So you need stakeholder empathy, which means you need to know what their priorities are. You need to know what's important to them. You need to know where the business is going, and you need to know what they'll react to and like what you need to do, right? Mm-hmm. Number two is customer empathy. So who is your customer? What are they doing? Have you looked at the usage logs one by one to really get a feeling for what they're doing? Have you done user research interviews and all that? And then the last one, which maybe is, I should have said first because it's kind of lame, but it's product empathy. So do you know your product inside and out? Salesforce is a very complicated product. Now, that's just the sales piece is complicated, but then there's platform, and then there's mobile, and then there's the ecosystem, and then there's the AppExchange and all that other stuff. It gets very complicated very quickly. And if you don't have all three of those pieces as a data person, you're not going to have a good time, and your impact is not going to be as much as the next person who has all three of those things. So what I learned at Salesforce was that there is an immense amount of non-data skill that one needs to learn in order to be an effective data person in a corporation like that.
Mm, I see. Especially, I think, in the business setting. It's like, how do you, the data science, the data is your tool and your weapon to how do you use this based on the person?
Right. That's exactly it. And so another saying I have is like, analysis does no good if it just stays on your local computer.
Right.
Right. It's like, even if you came up with the most groundbreaking freaking money-making thing, analysis.
Right.
How you infect the org with that insight is also a skill that is hard to do.
Right.
Yeah. And I think those three points also speak to like a core issue I see in a lot of data science. I see at work, where is like, models can give you numbers, which sounds like a great answer to whatever the problem is, but you can maybe someone's very good at selling the numbers and convincing other people to make decisions based on that, but mm-hmm. whether the numbers actually mean anything or not, whether the model is any good, a lot of times, like the end users are can be easily duped for a while, mm-hmm. and that's like a that's a hard thing to balance, I think, in data science, because there's like this really strong information asymmetry, and like you can give these results, but the value of the results, whether they're good or not, like has this time lag before everyone knows it. And that's like a big challenge I see a lot.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you're hinting at something that doesn't get talked about a ton, but I think information asymmetry is a great way to put it, because the data person is extremely intimate with the data, knows how dirty it is, knows all the exceptions and everything. An interesting way to look at it though is the purpose of the data scientist to recite a number, or is the purpose of the data scientist to implement change within their organization? You know, you're not getting paid to crunch numbers. You're getting paid to guide the product team to go do something, to guide the exec team, to, you know, be an evangelist for the customer within your org. And so there is a very delicate balance between balancing all those details, because there's no right answer, and no stakeholder wants to look at a spreadsheet. They want the takeaway. So like, right. That's another skill, which storytelling is a whole nother subtopic that I'll probably put in that long form piece too. That's yeah.
So you had this kind of this career at Salesforce, and we talked a little bit about like your transitions, but you know, how did you decide to leave? So first, I guess the first transition was from a big corporate to a startup. So what was the thinking then, and what was the plan?
Yeah. So after Salesforce, I had gotten the director role, and I was managing a team. And the team that I was on went through a bit of a turbulent time. And my thought process was a bit more not closed-minded, short-sighted, I guess you could say. So the solution to my unhappiness at work was basically, it wasn't like, oh, let's go find another job at Salesforce. It wasn't like, you know, I applied to a few other startup jobs to see how I could do it, to see if it would go. And I actually applied to Waymo way back then. And the recruiter, very lovely woman, said, you've never done a startup before. Are you sure you could handle it? And it's like, what? Who do you think I am? It was whatever. But so that ended up not working. And then, you know, I was with my wife on a small vacation, like a week vacation, and we had decided to go do the travel thing again. Mm-hmm. And so this was round two when did the travel thing, but this time with my then girlfriend at the time, and we went to Bali. And this time we actually lived in one spot for a while. So we were in Bali for, you know, 4 months, and we got a spot and chilled out there for a little bit. The other difference between this one too is it wasn't just pure travel. I was working on projects. So I was like building apps and like, you know, coding away and doing all that.
So did you just leave Salesforce and go on this like coding stuff on your own?
That's it.
And was it like consulting, little projects,
things like that? It was me messing around. Like I was building Python web apps. Like I was just like, I wasn't doing anything. Like, I was just like exploring my own curiosities. I started a small side project, small business that was a good passion project, but it made a little bit of money, but it wasn't much. But yeah, I left Salesforce because also I was pretty sure I wanted to leave there, but before I got my next job, I wanted to do the travel thing. And, you know, my then girlfriend, now wife, and I were just, excited to go on this adventure together. And so we ended up doing that. It was fabulous. Like I said, I started a small project where I started making, you know, those 3D mountains, like the 3D relief mountains that people sometimes have, where it's like either like CNC'd out of wood. And it's like literally like a physical people are holding. Yeah. I wanted to make those, but in bronze. Right.
In bronze. So, okay.
Yeah. So it's a big, long process, but it dealt with a lot of 3D printing and 3D modeling. And then I made them over in bronze. There's a whole website
in Bali. Called,
that's where I started learning the process, because it's manufacturing. And so like, I had no idea how to make these things in the first place. And so Bali kicked me off. And I learned all the things not to do when I was in Bali. And then when I came back to California, it was a little bit easier. Right. The website for that is terramano.co. If anybody wants to go check those
terramano.co. We'll add it to the notes.
Yeah. Anyway, so I ended up doing that, and it didn't really work out. It didn't really work out like I needed it to. And so I started applying to jobs, and I've learned in my career that the way you go get a job is you don't apply through the front door, like ubers.career.com. You hit the ground and you go emailing. You go cold emailing and cold intros to people. And that's what I ended up doing to my next role over at Digits. I hit up both the founders. I gave them the quick pitch. They were into it. I leaned back on my Salesforce name and I went for it. And I guess I should say this too, because I think it's kind of interesting for a data audience. As I was leaving Salesforce, I had a mentor tell me during a one-on-one, "Hey, Greg, I think you should shoot more. You should shoot for more than being just the data person." Mm-hmm. And I go, "What do you mean?" And she goes, "You're advising a lot of the decision makers. So you'll come up with an analysis and you'll recommend to product what they should do. You'll recommend to the GM what they should do, but you're never the one making the actual decision. And so if you want to get further along in that realm, I think you're going to have to go outside the data world." And so I was shook after that. I'm almost like, who am I anymore? I don't know. what is my purpose? What is my personality? And so since I learned that, since I had that realization or insight from her, I have explored data adjacent careers. And that's what I specifically explored within the startup. I told the founders, like, "Hey, I did growth over at Salesforce. That's no problem for me. Like, that's going to be good. Frameworks, all that other stuff. I'll do that in my sleep. What I want to grow into, though, is I want to grow into the COO track. So that doesn't mean I want to be your COO. That means I want to point that direction and start to go that route. So help with the monetization model, help with RevOps, help with stitching together all our SaaS applications, be the Zapier and automations expert within the org. Do all your product analytics, stand up your ETL process." So it's much, much more than just doing data analysis. And so that's what I ended up doing at Digits, which was a fabulous learning experience. I mean, the team was extremely smart, great engineers, great founders. And it was a lovely time, and I ended up being with them for 3 years. So it was a solid time.
Yeah.
Wow.
But then I guess throughout this whole time, you kept up like the YouTube, the content creation things on the side.
Yeah. Good question. So, like I said, at the beginning of COVID, I did like 2 months of the pandas stuff, right?
Right.
Two months. And my play was the SEO play. And so I stopped after 2 months and I did nothing, right? Mm-hmm. For the first like 3 months, there was no traffic. And then in month four, after I did all that stuff, then it was a little bit, then it was a little bit more, then it was a little bit more. And it peaked up at 90,000 uniques a month for the site, just off of pandas tutorials, which was pretty sweet. And I tried getting B2B sponsors, but the problem was that I picked the wrong content. Mm. And the reason why I was wrong is because, remember in the days before any LLM support, if you had a question on a coding anything, you'd Google it, go to Stack Overflow, copy some code, and then leave and then just go somewhere else, right? The same thing was happening to I optimized it for a click in, click out. Nobody stayed on my website. No emails, no retention, the bounce rate was absurd. No time on. Everything was not great for that. So if anybody wants to talk about that, that's a whole different topic. So did that. And then in January of this past year, over that time, I'd culminated like, it was 2000 subscribers on YouTube, which whatever, I wasn't even paying attention to it. It was like maybe $1 a day in, AdSense or whatever. It wasn't anything. It was so little that I would have to like let like 2 months build up before I hit the payment threshold and they actually send me the check. Right. But then I saw the Hacker News show Hacker News blog post for LangChain. Mm-hmm. And I was reading the comments. I had no idea what it was. I read the comments, and the comments were weirdly optimistic. And you know, Hacker News comments, they're like usually like freaking coming with their pitchforks for anything new. And I read that and I was like, oh, this is interesting. And I had already started to mess around with the OpenAI API just a little bit. And then I looked more deeply into LangChain and I was like, holy cow, this is solving all the hard parts of working with the OpenAI API right now. And I just thought to myself, what pandas is to data analysis, LangChain seems to be to the LLM world.
All right.
And I was like, oh yeah, this is great. And the cool part about language models is that the barrier to entry is super low. It's not a deeply, deeply technical topic. And people are figuring all this stuff out in the beginning, like just to start. And so I made my first video, just a Loom freaking video, you know, nothing going on. Yeah. And I put it up on YouTube. It was like an intro to LangChain or like LangChain 101 or whatever. And that next day, I was getting like 3 or 4 subscribers a day just off my old content from 2 years ago. And then I got 16 new subscribers after that LangChain video. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. That's sweet. And then the next day it was 25. I didn't even put out a new video. It was 25 the next day. I was like, wait a minute, what? And so I started pumping out videos and it went to 45 new subscribers in a day. And then it went to 100. I was like, what is going on here? And I'm telling my wife, I go, babe, this doesn't ever happen. It's like, I've been in this content game for long enough that this does not happen like this. Uh-huh. And so I would say I put my foot on the gas pedal about 30% as much as I probably should have back then. Cause like, if you remember the early 23 hype, I mean, that was just nuts. It was just all over the place. And I started doing stuff. I was full-time on it. I was like making content. I was really just following my curiosities, like exploring these new things. Right. Like even the concept of email generation was novel back then.
Right. Right.
And it was take something about the company, take an email template and it will output a personal. It was novel, right?
Yeah.
it was a wild time. anyway, so I'm doing that and it peaked at 550 new subscribers in a day. Which again, isn't a ton, but it was really cool. It was transformational at that time for me. And so now in August of 23, we're at 33,000 subscribers. And I've told myself that it doesn't get interesting until you hit 100K. And so that's the next milestone, but we'll see if we want to get there or not.
Yeah.
It's on its way.
Well, I need to put out more content for it first. And so y'all didn't ask about the evolution of how I approach content, because that's changed a whole bunch too. And what was me just doing tutorials like on Loom, I asked myself, Greg, if you wanted to take this to the next level, like if you really want to give this a good shot, what do you need to do for it? Right. And so there's a whole list of things that I thought about, but that's a different topic. And I don't want to jump into it if y'all don't want to take it there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's go there. Cause I think that's part of the process.
Cause that's
mastery. And I think at some point we also just like you mentioned, like having a plan before diving into like doing the YouTube stuff full time.
Yeah.
Want to hear about that too, but it sounds like they're connected.
With the YouTube part?
Yeah. Like
it's all connected, you know, I mean, everyone's a list of experiences. Like I said, at the beginning, I think my content has resonated well because I spent so much time doing stakeholder management at Salesforce, learning what are their goals, what is going to be impactful at the business, how do I spend my energy? And then it was that same thing at the startup. But at that point, it's like, there's no corporate crib that you're in. You're like, you're up against the raw world and users may or may not like your product. And you got to figure out what the heck you're going to do. Right. And so between all those things, I think it set me up into a good position to be like, okay, what are cool, impactful projects that I want to do to showcase these language models? Which areas aren't explored that I think will do well? And then you combine that with my scrappy Python skill. I tell people all the time that it won't be performant and it probably won't be secure, but you're going to be able to read it like plain English because I need it simple. If I'm going to teach a technical topic, I need it dead simple. So it's heavily commented. That's why I love Jupyter Notebooks, because the markdown in between, all that good stuff. And so did that combine that with the YouTube stuff that I did a couple of years prior? I mean, I think it's cool. I mean, y'all and I, you two and I are talking right now, but like by no means do I consider what I've done a success at all so far. Like there's a long way to go to get to where I want and for my goals. And so it almost feels a little premature to be talking. And I wish that this podcast was like in like 3 or 4 years, And maybe
well, let's do it.
Yeah.
Round two.
Yeah, we'll do round two. But no, man, it's a journey. It's fun. Yeah, it's a journey. It's fun. Yeah.
So what are the things that just the high level, like from the early videos to now, like mm-hmm. you mentioned, if I want to get serious about this, this yeah. is what I need to do differently. What are the key things?
Yeah. So one of my key learnings was through a creator coach. His name is Jay. He's been great so far. He made it pretty clear to me, like, hey, Greg, you're not going to out expert anybody. Like, you're not going to out expert anybody. That hit me hard. Number right. two is, Greg, you don't want to be in the game where you're trying to say that your list of 10 things is better than someone else's list of 10 things. That's not a good place to be in as a creator, right? And so he's really helping me work on what he calls the premise, which is who are you and why do you do what you do? And how do you position yourself so that you're competing against no one else? It's just you. So there's a bajillion AI newsletters out there. There's a bajillion AI content and bajillion AI tutorials and all that out there, right? How can I formulate my premise that others won't say that they do, right? And so he's helping me really, really narrow in on where that is. I'm not quite ready to share exactly what it is because it's still sure. getting figured out. But think of it as, how do you create a trailer for you, Greg, about mm-hmm. the journey that you're on and what you do? So he's been helping me a lot with that, and it's been really nice. I'll let you know how that goes afterwards. But then it's like also little things. It's like, how do you upgrade your setup? You know, how do you right. sound better? How do you just do small tactical things? I was talking to one audience member really early in my journey, and I go, hey, so I haven't really put that much time into my setup. What do you think? He goes, well, there's two types of audience members, Greg. So there's the ones who don't give a shit, and there's the people who really care for the good production. He goes, I care for good production. So I think you should really end up set up. So like little things like that. And then just recently, I started working with an editor, because if I really looked at the content process, like what takes the most time? Freaking video editing, right?
Yeah.
And in the day of good YouTube is edited. There is a story, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm writing the scripts because that's the content. That's my bread and butter. And I'm getting better at that. It's not by no means there yet, but the tactical editing, I needed to outsource because I wasn't good at it and it was taking a lot of time. And it degraded my content a little bit because, you know, it wasn't as good. Now, there's some people that'll say, oh, I want the content to speak for itself. And if you're Andre Caparthy and you can put up a video about how to do a transformer from scratch, yeah, of course, you're going to get 3 million views and you're going to do great. I mean, that's fabulous. Yeah. That isn't the type of positioning that I can lean back on, nor do I necessarily want to. I'm trying to position myself in another type of way. And so with that comes the need for a little bit more editing.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So cool to hear like the breakdown of these steps to like take it to the next level. Cause you're like at this, like you mentioned, like at this interesting, you know, hopefully in between phase where the channel and the content has started to take off in this new way, yeah. and it's going to land somewhere, and you're figuring out how to strap rockets to it so it can land farther.
That's exactly it. Cause if I'm really harping in on the content side, I mean, content is an equation, right? You have your audience funnel, but then you also have your content operations funnel. How many ideas can you get? How many of those ideas can you execute on? And then how well do those ideas actually end up doing, right? That's the content side, but then you have your whole like audience side, which is the discovery. I think Jay Klaus puts it as the audience platforms and discovery platforms, and then your relationship platforms and owning your media. There's just, it's so, so deep, but yeah. the operator in me enjoys the game of it all. Mm-hmm. Like it's fun. I mean, yeah. I wish that it was paying just a little bit more right now so I could like, I could go to a party and like not have to like front, you know what I mean? like front, like how things are going with it. But no, it's beautiful. It's a fun time. And I have an extremely supportive wife who helps me throughout the process.
Great. All right. And also maybe one last thing that except YouTube, like how should folks follow you and hear more about you, what you're up to? And maybe in potential getting contact with you.
Yeah. You know, sometimes people say, Greg, let's connect on LinkedIn. And I'm like, why? for what? That's a little bit of a jerk thing to say, but no, I don't really do LinkedIn. So I would say Twitter is good. And I think if you search hard enough, you could find my email. I don't necessarily want to give it, but my DMs are open on Twitter and they will be for the foreseeable future. So just hit me up there.
Cool. All right. So let's wrap this up. All right. Thank you for your conversation. And it's really been insightful. And our guest today has been Greg Kamrat. Greg, thank you for being part of The Craft. And thank you for listening to The Craft Podcast and for all of you. So for more links and information about this episode or to listen to more episodes, you can search for The Craft Podcast by Daniel Tedesco and Michael Du on YouTube or anywhere you get your podcasts. And see you next time. And until then, keep crafting.